You're listening to The Takeout.
This is an extra special Legends edition of The Takeout podcast. I'm Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News, joined as I am every episode, special or otherwise, by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris, the political director of CBS News. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
Why is this a special Legends edition of The Takeout podcast? Because in our presence is an actual broadcast legend. Mm-hmm. Now, there are lots of legends at CBS News. One of the great privileges of working for this phenomenal company is you meet people who are revered, and understandably so, in the field of journalism. But there is one particular person at CBS whose career is immortalized and memorialized in a very popular and very successful and very funny movie called Broadcast News. The character was Jane Craig, played by Holly Hunter, inspired by our legendary guest today, Susan Zirinsky of CBS News. Hello, Susan.
Guys, I think I need to ditch my lawyer and have you, Major Garrett, stop the White House and navigate my next contract. Seriously.
I'm ready, willing, and able, Susan Zirinsky, to do exactly that. Thank you for joining us. Why is Susan with us? Well, and where are we? Where are we, by God, Steve? Tell us. Where are we?
We are in the bowels. The CBS
Could
broadcast.
Could you not use that word?
Well,
how about the lower
They're not obstructed.
Level?
They're not obstructed
But
bowels.
You have eaten here. Oh, sorry. That's terrible.
Because
the
oh my
food
God.
Actually is not bad. We are in the basement
yes.
of the
Otherwise
CBS
known as the basement. Yes.
Broadcast Center.
In New York City.
In New York City.
Gotham, as I like
yes,
to call
Manhattan,
it.
Yes, Manhattan, 57th and 10th.
The only place in New York City at this moment where there is no traffic because of the UN.
Right.
Right here.
Well, nobody
exactly.
can get here because
nobody
of all the traffic.
Nobody can get here because of all the traffic. Exactly.
We are in the Primetime Cafe, formerly known as Station Break.
Isn't that clever?
They've had a redo of the cafeteria
Those CBS
in,
people.
In the last
so
year. And it's
arch,
beautiful and the food
so
is lovely.
So clever. Yes. And Susan Zirinsky is here to talk about a couple of things. Her legendary career, of course, but also a very important anniversary for a very important program on the CBS network, 48 Hours. Which Susan is the executive producer thereof, correct?
Correct, senior executive producer. If you're going to negotiate my contract, you got to get that part
exactly.
right.
Exactly.
Already stumbling in your new gig.
No, listen, I read his daily White House notes, multiple notes. They're very detailed, so I just don't want him to have a fat mouth.
Senior executive yep. producer, ladies and gentlemen. So tell us a little bit about two things with 48 Hours. What's big about the 30th season, and how has the show evolved?
The show has really gone through a series of major innovative and sort of, I don't know, evolutionary lives. In fact, 48 Hours was the first truth reality show. It really began with a man named Sir Howard Stringer, former head of CBS News, former head of CBS Network, former head of Sony. And they had an idea in 86, January of 86. They did a documentary on Crack Street. And 48 Hours was born of the concept that you would launch a number of reporters and a number of crews on a clock. You would start a clock, and it was 48 hours. And you captured as much as you could. Now, obviously, there was work done ahead of time, and you cited your stories. You had access in certain places. And so it was this immersive, experiential broadcast. And it was revolutionary. It really was revolutionary. I was not working on it at that point. Andrew Hayward, a former president of CBS News, was the first executive producer of the series. Howard Stringer was the executive producer of 48 Hours on Crack Street. The Crack Street was really a remarkable show. It really unveiled a drug epidemic, much like the opioid epidemic is now, that was really taking hold across the country. And its effects were devastating, from older people to children. And so when this show was well-received, and the concept of 48 Hours was so interesting for journalists, there was no filter. It's kind of like the evolution of some of the broadcasts today, like our own CBSN on assignment, Vice, those successful broadcasts are because you're on that journey. You're not taking it, reporting it back years later. You're in it. You're seeing it. So that is really the beginning of 48 Hours. And when they felt that urgency and that real connection with the audience, they launched it in a series a couple of years later in about January. And the series went on really uninterrupted for about 7 or 8 years. But that's a long amount of time to give something just 48 hours. And the evolution was the audience was craving a little more. There's only so many places that you can experience for 2 days and two nights. And sometimes I made a joke because when the emperor died in Japan and 48 hours came to shoot it, it felt more like 48 years that they were shooting. But indeed, they were there for 48 hours. They cheated the clock a little bit, but not really. So the show then evolved to single subjects. And that was somewhat successful, but the urgency didn't feel like it was there. And it went through some reflective times. And I came in 96, which seems like decades ago. It was.
It actually is.
Yeah. You know, it's like I blink and it's like, yeah. I'm not going to say on radio, on the podcast, how long I've been at CBS. But let's just say it's under 50 years. And my keychain is actually older than most of the people I work with. My keychain, a souvenir from a Reagan-Gorbachev meeting in the 80s in Geneva. Anyway, I digress. So 48 Hours went through several incarnations of who are we, what are we. We live in the house of the venerable 60 Minutes. They're celebrating a monumental anniversary in their 50th. But 48 going into its 30th season, which officially is January, but this is the kind of, we call it the seasonal anniversary. We really ended up evolving to something that had a place in our time, which is law and justice. And, you know, we went through a 48 Hours Investigates. But the crime and justice beat felt so rich and something that we could have an impact on. And so over the last decade and a bit more, we really took on this banner. When you live in the 60 Minutes network, you know, I'm not going to go compete for stories with them. But we evolved to this very interesting place. We have a national reputation. It's an extraordinary beat. We make no apologies. Sometimes there's criticism. Oh, you're so prurient. But you know what? You know, we're celebrating our 30th anniversary. We've gotten close to 8 people out of jail for wrongful convictions. We've solved multiple cold cases, cold for more than 20 years. You know, it is not uncommon for us to follow a story for 6 hours, different hours, over. Aaron Moriarty has been reporting on a story for 20 years on a wrongful conviction, and the guy just got a new hearing. There is a chance that this man will get out. So the evolution of 48, living in the venerable house of CBS, really became a law and justice show to live alongside 60 Minutes and our hard news colleagues. And quite often the lines intersect, so we jump into the hard news side. We jump into the hard news side. So that's who we are now.
And it's not just to broadcast anymore. It's now really a law and justice platform right within CBS.
Absolutely. We cover a lot of different things. I think the interesting thing also for our role, which I will just say because it's an important role for us, we have for the network become kind of the primetime crash unit. So if there is a breaking story, even if it's not quite law and justice, but when it is, absolutely. So if Muhammad Ali dies, we'll do a special. The police shootings in Dallas, which really was under our umbrella, we turn around and do a special. Mary Tyler Moore dies. Not quite my beat. We do a special. Inauguration. I worked with Major. I worked with all of you guys. We did a special.
Terrorist attacks in France.
Absolutely.
The night before the CBS televised Democratic debate in Des Moines, Iowa. We were all there. We shifted not only to the debate questions themselves, but an entire, as we were preparing for that debate, we turned an entire special around in which some of us were involved.
Yes, it was very interesting because we were in our post-production room and we were posting the other show that we were doing for the next night, which preceded the CBS debate. And it was like 5:20 or something. This thing explodes. I'm watching CBS. I'm reading the wires. I'm talking to the desk. And at about 5:45, I called President David Rhodes and Steve Kappas, who were at the location. And I said, look, we have to do this tomorrow. I'm launching a primetime special because we're going to precede the debate. It shouldn't even be any discussion. So there was 10 seconds of silence, and they said, okay, that's a pretty good idea. I said, glad you agree. I've already launched like four teams over to France. So thanks for coming along, boys.
Hey. Classic insight into not only the instincts, the judgment, but the quick decision-making process that is Susan Zirinsky, and why, when she has a conversation like that, the network president and the executive producer of CBS Evening News say, yes.
Yeah,
and it's already been done.
Look, I feel that, you know, I want to mention something because there are some reporters and the producer and the teams we work with. 48 is a very unique operation in the broadcast industry. It's a very, very collegial group. It is less about individual success than it is about the encompassing the group. When we do a special like that, everybody comes together. Our reporters, you know, especially the people that have been here, you know, a long time, Aaron Moriarty, Peter Van Sant, Richard Schlesinger, Maureen Maher, Tracy Smith, who does stuff with us in Sunday Morning. These people really take great pride. A, when we have to crash a special, they're in there. They want a piece of that. But also in the Law and Justice beat, they spend enormous amounts of hours researching, talking to people. We now are asked to join conferences all over the country, homicide investigations, defense attorneys, prosecutors. We are recognized. Listen, the competition is brutal. I've covered a lot of wars in my life. I'm telling you, primetime is really a scary place to be. You don't know who the enemy is, quite frankly. But our reporters have such a vested interest in these stories. That's why, I mean, it is not uncommon for us to do. There was a case of a guy, a young guy, convicted of murdering his parents, Martin E. Tancliffe, the day before his senior in high school. We did over a seven-year period probably 6 to 8 hours updating the case. Marty Tancliffe is out of prison. Marty Tancliffe graduated law school, passed the bar, is married, and, you know, credits us with really having taken his case on and said, this can't happen. This did not happen.
And not only is 48 Hours celebrating its 30th year in broadcasting, but it is, like many shows, this one included, embracing a new form of communicating your stories through a podcast.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, for our season premiere, we are doing a series of 6 podcasts. It's an experiment for us. I think we were a little shocked, you'll appreciate this, at the enormity of the work that it took. I have done podcasts before, but I've had outside people kind of doing them under our tutelage. This was Aaron Moriarty and several of the producers and the senior, Judy Tigard. They wrote 20 to 25-minute episodes. There's 6 of them. They do mirror the kind of the parameters of the show, but they're a much deeper dive. And in our producing of these, it's much more like a serial. The producer and Aaron, they're talking, they're discussing what happened and how things evolved, and then that's woven into the storyline. Interestingly enough, I'm kind of taking a podcast approach to the broadcast itself, in that we have to. One of the reasons why I love this podcast is because you're not only giving me story, you're kind of giving me how did you get there? What were you thinking? What's the evolution, as you said, of 48? In our show this season, as kind of something new and fresh, which kind of goes back to our roots at 48, which was seeing it happen, we are going to take the journey. I'm seeing the correspondent on their way, talking to the producer, so that you appreciate the revelations as we are discovering them, you are discovering them.
And you mentioned a word when you were talking about the original concept for 48 Hours, this immersive experience. One thing we have learned through this podcast is that's precisely what a podcast is. Mm-hmm. It is an immersive experience for people. They block out time. They may be running or working out or washing the dishes or doing something else, but this is where their head is at, literally where their head is at.
Absolutely.
And they are taking it all in a way that maybe not as intense an experience as watching something on television, which sounds counterintuitive, but it is not.
But you know what it is? It's an old concept that has a new technology, right? The old concept of radio, theater of the mind, give people, let people think about what they're listening
immersed.
To. Immersed.
I have on my desk upstairs 2 pieces of wood I found them, and somebody I thought I found them, but somebody else actually found them and brought them to me. They are sound effects from CBS radio from the 30s. One is a train whistle and one is a boat whistle. And when I played them, I thought to myself, oh, you're captured in radio. But there is a personalized feeling about the podcast. I'm so happy that podcasts exist because as a runner, I was running to News Radio 88, which was a little pathetic because I didn't really need the traffic report. Right. So a podcast gives me a little more intellectual challenge. So on mile 3 and 4, I'm not dying to have some other feature on, you know, 1010 or 88. I'm in a podcast and I'm at a chapter. So I kind of am taking podcast technology and incorporating it into the broadcast as a whole.
So the podcast that you the 6-episode podcast you have coming out, it's affiliated with an episode of 48 Hours.
That's correct. We are, you know, our show for the season premiere is kind of a doubleheader. One is a special that is O.J. Simpson. We call it the End Game because on the night of the 30th, at midnight, it is potential that O.J. Simpson will walk out of Lovelock or wherever prison he's going to be at that moment after a 9-year sentence. And so we really felt we should take note of this iconic trial. And James Brown from CBS News and CBS Sports, I should say CBS Sports first because I love Sean McManus, don't want to make him mad. But James Brown is the anchor, host, reporter of this hour, and it's a fascinating look at O.J. Simpson about to walk out of prison, but also at this iconic trial that was much more about celebrity, justice, domestic violence, and most importantly, race. This one trial, as an iconic moment in our history, showed that, you know what? Everything is not okay. It was a totally racially divided verdict, and the repercussions have played out now over almost a 10-year period. And the relationship with cops and the black community is not better. So that's a very interesting look. That's at 9. And then at 10, we do the Aaron Moriarty, where the podcasts are. And it's about a black widow. And what was interesting for us and why we've made it the season premiere is because of our credibility, we have access, really unusual access. We do have the defense. We do have the prosecution. But we have the judge. And we have the jury, and it's a really shocking ending because this woman ends up being accused of 2 murders.
Else we also have is we have a little bit of a sound of this. Arden, number one, please.
Every case has twists and turns. Every single case does. But few cases have these twists and turns that just take you aback.
Underneath that very respectable surface, it seems like everything's rotting to the core.
When you have success, sometimes that makes people more interested in your downfall.
I'll just say we waited for the autopsy.
And what did the autopsy say?
Homicide.
All right, in that short period of sound, you have just about every element of either great literature for hundreds of years, downfall, false flags about a life being lived that looks publicly all in order but is not internally, death, curiosity, the piling or the gathering of evidence. It's all right there.
When Sean McManus took over as president of CBS News and he took me out to lunch to kind of talk about what 48 Hours was, early on in the lunch he turned to me and he said, how many of them are there? And I stopped for a second. I said, what are you talking about? What do you mean? He goes, well, how long can you keep this going, 48 hours and crime? I said, start with Adam and Eve. No, right. I said, I think we're going to be okay. Look, you know, I part of me really wishes, and we'll probably evolve to this, that the multi-platform approach, which now has to be the reality for everything we do. You know, Major Garrett, you're working on a book. I'm hope I'm not. I'm like,
no, that's unveiled. Exactly right. I am.
So you're working on a
breaking
book.
Breaking news.
And so we're all into multiple disciplines, which creates an enriched experience. If I'm watching you and I've watched you all through the campaign and I'm a normal mortal human being and I know you're putting a book out about the first year, I want it. I want it. So we're all in this multi-platform evolution, and that's what I love about our business now. I just wish I could turn the clock back and have more life.
Well, I want to ask you about that. So, and I don't want to date you, but I mean, I'd like to date you, but wow. I don't want to age you.
Okay. I think I'll just scoot back.
Susan Zirinsky. I just want to put that out
right.
there for
we
she's
all
the,
do.
One of the loveliest people
I knew
I've
him
ever
when he didn't wear a tie, so just
back in, yeah.
and was dateable.
Yeah, yeah exactly.
But in when you started at CBS, there was not this idea of multi-platform. There was not this idea of talk to us about what the business was like when you got into the business. And if you could just clue us in, not to age
no,
you, but
I don't
what
care.
Year you started here at CBS.
You know, hey, listen, I work out 10 times a week. I'm
10 more times than I do.
I'm over,
just to clarify.
You know, actually, 12 here, more times than you
here's
do. You're
the thing.
In the negative.
I can prove that if you're over 60, you can still be cute. And, you know, it's just that's the way I thank you very much. What's my score? But the reality
plus.
Is
whatever it is you're winning.
I got a job part-time 2 weeks after the Watergate break-in. There was an opening for the desk assistant in the Washington Bureau. And it was an extraordinary time. I was a sophomore in college. I was at American University. I was a government and journalism major. And it was, it beats any dating site. Well, I wasn't dating a lot, so it really actually gave me something to do on Saturday night. The assignment editor was a guy named Bill Galbraith. And he had the idea that as the junior member of the entire organization, that I would go out with a crew every Saturday night and look for Deep Throat, because the theory was that Woodward and Bernstein were getting their dumps of fantastic information for the Washington Post that was very revelatory about the Nixon White House. Every Sunday, the Washington Post would like break some major story. So Bill Galbraith thought, we're going to find the garage, because everybody knew they were meeting in a garage. I went with a now deceased cameraman named Cal Marlin most Saturday nights to every garage in a 50-mile radius of Washington, Virginia, and Maryland. So let's just say I never ran into Deep Throat.
Did you actually go to the Roslyn Garage where they did meet?
I don't know if I ever actually hit that one, sadly enough. But I would go back to the dorm. I was living in the dorm with these like ridiculous stories, and my roommates would be puking from having gone out Saturday night. And I'm talking about, and I was outside the Jefferson Hotel staking out John Mitchell, who for some reason was meeting with some Cubans. Like, what the hell is going on? And they're like, what? What? So look, you know what? For me, there were no dating apps back then. But it was much better than Christian Mingle or any of the other...
Garage apps.
Garage apps.
A lot of garage apps.
So my evolution was really as an undergrad, and it was an incredible seduction because journalism, which is a little bit different now when we are a punching bag for so many, but journalism was really seen as holding people accountable and... The seriousness, I called my dad one night and I said, because I wanted to be a film director. That is what was my mission. And I said, this is what I have to do. This is feels so important, and yet it's television, so images are important. And this is the combination of what I want to do. So I began working 2 weeks after the Watergate break-in part-time while I was in college.
So you've got to tell us the broadcast news story.
That's kind of a hilarious story.
That's why you have to tell it to us.
So it was 1984, and it was the last night of the convention in San Francisco. And I was a floor producer, which meant that I had Ed Bradley, Leslie Stahl, Bob Schieffer. They were the floor correspondents. And there were
other legends.
Other legends. Legends who I admire greatly. But I was there... I was their producer on the floor. And a floor producer at a convention is really in charge of knowing what the storylines were going to be, knowing what issues were coming up, and this was the last night, so it was a big night, knowing who to talk to. All good, but it was not uncommon for the executives to bring around very important people. In those days, CBS had a little more money, so we had a fairly large facility that gets put up into the convention center with multiple floors. We were in what was called the ready room. The correspondents would get outfitted with their headsets and mics. I had whatever gizmo to talk to the control room and everything else. And so then President Ed Joyce was walking around some man, and I didn't pay any attention because I'm not Ed Bradley, Bob Schieffer, Leslie Stahl. I'm kind of doing my index cards of who I've talked to. And eventually the guy comes over and they said, hey, this is Susan Zirinsky. She's the White House producer. Those days I was the White House producer. So we greet each other, and he said, you know, hey, listen, I'd love to get together and chat. And I said, well, I had no idea who the guy was. I said, I'm a little busy. You know, I'm about to go onto the convention floor. But the convention's over tomorrow. We're in San Francisco, evening news, 3:30. We're off the air. What if we meet at 4:30? Great. I kept saying to him, you look so familiar to me. So he walks out, and Leslie Stahl looks at me, and I won't say everything that she said, but she said, you are a blank moron. The reason he looked so familiar is because he got 8 Academy Awards for Terms of Endearment. That's James L. Brooks. I said, wow, he did the Maritime Moore Show. Yep. So the next day, I am supposed to do the Reagan piece. Tom Battag, then executive producer of the evening news, I call in. I said, what are you thinking? And he goes, you know what? We got so many people here. You're about to go on the road for 6 months. Take the day. My partner in crime at that point was working in the Washington Bureau. His name is Joe Perinen, came out of Chicago WBBM-TV. Mm-hmm. And Joe and I had begun living together several years before. Really good for CBS. One hotel room, 2 major producers, really helpful even back then. So
Very tidy expense again.
So they said, you know, enjoy the day. Take the day. You're leaving Saturday. All good. So I said, hey, Joe, I don't have to do the Reagan piece. We got the day. And he looked at me and said, you got the blood test with you? I said, what do you mean? He goes, you got the blood test. I said, like in the marriage blood test? He goes, yeah. He said, call City Hall. Let's see if we can elope. I called City Hall. They said, out of state? Yes. Blood tests? Got them. Come on down. And Friday was half off. That's half off the expense. took a cable car down. Now, in those days, CBS, you weren't allowed to be married and working in the same kind of environment. But we took a chance. We told no one. But then we realized we needed a witness. Oh, my God. Like, holy crap. Like, where am I going to get a witness? So we called the videotape trailer because we knew somebody we knew would be there. Very famous editor Charlie Wilson, who was famous for the very funny years-old Tapes of Wrath. Charlie, are you doing something for the next hour and 10 minutes? No. Can you come to City Hall? He said, are you in trouble? I said, maybe.
Right. Might be. You never can tell.
He comes. He
to be continued.
He is our witness. And we get married in a ceremony that lasted 2 minutes and 39 seconds. I had a CBS shipping bag with the sweatshirts I had ordered from the convention. And we get married. So, yes, we get married. And we call our family. We call Dan Rather. We call management just to tell them everything's good. Champagne is arriving. All of that. But I had arranged to meet
James L. Brooks come back into the
story? On your wedding day.
I had arranged to meet James L. Brooks the next day at about 4 o'clock. So I look at my watch and I say to my new husband,
right.
Hey, Joe, I said, you know, there's this screenwriter who had Joyce brought around, and I got a meeting with him at 4 o'clock. He goes, like, you're going now? And I said, well, yeah, as the champagne and the caviar are arriving. So I go and meet Jim Brooks, and I said to him, if I like you, I'm going to tell you something amusing. His questions, it was fantastic. It was interesting. He really wanted to know, what does a producer do? What does a White House producer do? Mm. How do you integrate into the system? When you go into a war zone, is everybody having sex? Is everybody doing drugs and drinking? And
answer, sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Sometimes yes. I had an acronym, which I probably cannot say on the air.
Sure you can.
But I was TBTF, and that was too busy to figure it out. That was what I was calling.
Not figure it out. The F is not for figure it out.
Don't
but anyway,
figure it out.
I think we can roll along.
You can handle that. I'm with him for like 3 hours. He really wants to know. Editorially, who's in charge? How do you work? Well, how do you deal with New York? How do you visualize a story? How do you get extra stuff? It was really an interesting conversation. He had worked at CBS as a desk assistant in his early years. So I look at my watch and I'm telling him, he said, well, what's your dating thing? I said, I didn't date very much. About 5 years ago, I began living with a guy from CBS Washington. And I looked at my watch and I said, in 4 hours and 13 minutes ago, I got married. He goes, what? We ran to the hotel. He wanted to meet Joe. We opened the door. Joe was napping. in his underwear, and
the
guy wiped him out. Is hugging him, and then Joe's looking at me and going, "Who is this?" So that was my wedding day, my meeting of James L. Brooks, last day of the Democratic Convention, and oh, what a year it was.
So ask your question about other characters in broadcast.
Well, I wanted to, a huge fan of broadcast news. I think that it's still to
this
day, and I think this is a testament to you and your work on the movie, it is really the most realistic portrayal of a TV newsroom, right? Even the technology's changed and things have changed in the newsroom, but I still to this day feel that it is.
Well, I got to actually write, like, the storylines that I had to drag Joe into it because I was working. It was happening. We were shooting the movie as Iran-Contra was breaking in Washington. So it was like, and they would shoot all night. So I would work all day, and then I would work all night, and I'd sleep for about 2 or 3 hours and go back into work. So I wrote a lot of the storylines for the movie, and so did my husband. The realism came with Brooks, who was an incredible writer. But Holly Hunter hung out with me in the newsroom. Albert Brooks hung out with Phil Jones up on Capitol Hill.
Wow.
One night, we were like struggling with this clothes.
Remind everybody who Phil Jones is.
Phil Jones
is one of my all-time favorite former CBS News correspondents.
Longtime CBS News correspondent. White House, Capitol Hill. He did 48 Hours. He's a phenomenal guy. He's retired now, but still very active. So Phil Jones was struggling because I never forget that Secretary of State Schultz had testified on the Hill, and we were like yelling about a last line. And Albert, who's like standing next to me, said, "Excuse me, I hope you don't mind." And he like said this line out loud, and Phil goes, "That's flipping awesome. Okay, that's it. We'll do that." So it was, they really studied who we were and how we did things. Also, I ended up going to Hollywood for about 2 weeks to write background dialogue for continuity so that things made sense, so that things had a purpose.
So two questions about the movie. One, in terms of the characters, everybody says you're the Holly Hunter character. Okay, great.
I mean, an amalgam. There were a lot of people. But as Leslie said, when they saw me crying, she goes, "Why would you have let him do that? Now everyone knows."
Were there any direct parallels for other characters and people that worked at CBS at the time?
I can't disparage people, but there were some threads of people that were at CBS, both in the Albert Brooks character and in the Bill Hurt character. The Bill Hurt character person is no longer here. There were even threads of Albert and his caring of Richard Schlesinger. So there were threads. Those were more amalgams. But what was so painful in the evolution of that movie is when they went through a major firing scene.
I want to ask you about this.
Yeah. The day that we were screening the rushes, you know, from having shot it like 2 days before, that was the day, and this was the thinking back then, there was a major cutback at CBS and in the Washington Bureau, and the theory was you let people come in, they're doing their job, you call them at about 1 p.m. to come in, and they get fired, and they had to leave immediately. So this one day, it was the first time I had ever experienced it, and really the Washington Bureau had ever experienced anything like that. Literally, people were on assignment. They came back. They were called in. And you saw this, like, it was like nuclear war. Like, suddenly people were walking out with a box. And that night, I went to the broadcast news hotel where they had set up a production unit, and we were screening the dailies, and I was like sobbing my eyes out because I was living it and then seeing it portrayed. That was why I think Jim Brooks really got to the essence of who we are and how much things mean and the dedication that I have seen throughout my life. I've had a lot of offers to go different places and different networks. I've never left. There is something unique about the soul of CBS, even when we've gone through really bad times. But I would say that now, and this really is a tribute to Jeff Fager, 60 Minutes executive producer, and then and chairman of CBS, and David Rhodes, they put CBS News back on a track with a core value of who we are and what we're about. And I hadn't really felt that since Watergate.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. So you've seen it all. I mean, you've seen CBS at its height. CBS when it had multiple layoffs in the 80s. The 90s, the Evening News going into third place, which was a big negative for there. And then the chaos throughout the 2000s, and now this sort of rise again. I came in to CBS in 99 and saw pretty much from started at the low point. Right, and it went lower, I think, before it came back up. And I agree with you completely about this organization. There is something about the soul of this organization. People here are unique. They're caring about each other. There is a huge history here. There are many, many legends who work here. And this is one of the reasons why I am obsessed with Susan Zirinsky, because you are a connection to a long time, that long time soul of CBS News.
I may be the only person that's vested in the old pension program. I actually think
that's
the
most important connection
really
to the old CBS. But you know all these stories. You know what this news division has been through over the years. Yet we have now survived and I think are coming around, as you said, to a point where we are thriving again. I have never felt this place so positive in the 18 years I've been here as I have in the last five years.
I was joking with you, Major, about your notes because they're extremely intense, but it really speaks to who we are as an organization. The information flow and the seriousness with which we are really about evolving as a network, CBSN, our digital part, our digital network. You know, even CBS Radio has this new resurgence. Even you're doing this podcast. It speaks to the fact that in the world we're trying to integrate into, we're not saying we can't. We're saying bring it on. And the morphing and the success of CBS is about things like this podcast, and it's about you writing a book. It's all value. No, but it's value added.
Trying
it's
to,
value
yeah.
added that we are an encompassing a group of people that have this goal. And it's not caca. It's pure. And I think people respond to that. Look, we use our phones. Like, you know, we live by our phones. But the reality is, as CBS has evolved, there is a connectivity to the old world that has been brought around full circle. And so our encompassing, like I love to live tweet when we're on the air. Like, would I like to do something else on a Saturday night? Maybe. I've disappeared into bathrooms with my iPad. I said, I'll be back in an hour. And they go, are you sick? I said, well, probably, but not in the way you think. But there's a connectivity.
Just news sick.
To the world.
It's a special kind of malady.
Listen, you know what? I feel...
We're all afflicted by and delighted to be so.
I feel lucky. You know, I did a documentary literally March after 9/11, which has had multiple lives with these French brothers, and it's been an incredible relationship. We did this doc called 9/11. Mm-hmm. It may be the most important piece of work of my career. But having the opportunity to do things like that within CBS, just about a year and a half ago, we did a doc for Showtime, and it also aired on CBS, called The Spy Masters, CIA in the Crosshairs. Every living director spoke to us about the war on terrorism. At first, I was a little afraid that we'd be like the apologists for the CIA. They were so self-flagellating that it was an incredible piece of work. So CBS allows you. I have a day job, but you're only limited by your own imagination here. And that's why I've stayed at CBS. I've even done a Britney Spears reality show. Not something I put on my resume, but
something that's on that guilty pleasure reel at home, I guarantee you. So before we let you go, because I know you do have that day job, from broadcast news, there are many famous lines, but one that always sticks out in my mind and some of our listeners is during that awful period when people are being laid off, an executive says to one of the correspondents, if there's anything I can do for you, just let me know. And the correspondent says, well, you could die.
I certainly hope you die soon.
I certainly hope you die soon, yes.
True story or no?
Is that a real line? Is that a compilation?
It is not a real line, but it certainly was the feeling of a couple of people that were in that office. It was like, wow. They were here just a minute ago. Brooks was really able to capture that this wasn't a job. This was a calling. And that the dedication and the soul of those of us that are here transcends management. And you know, we will. One of the reasons why I've chosen never to go into the management jobs, even though I respect and I really get how important they are, is that I feel the impact that I can have is through storytelling. It's through docs. It's through getting people out of jail. But I really believe that the soul of CBS is very different than the soul of other people. When people leave CBS, they never stop talking about it. Mm-hmm. They never, whether they've left voluntarily or they retire. I know because my husband is a former CBS. He's now a professor at NYU in journalism and at Hofstra. The truth is, he knows more gossip than I do.
Zee, I left and came back. I couldn't wait to get back. I was gone 2 years, and I could not wait to get back.
And can you name all 13 Supreme Court justices?
Probably not.
That's another line from the movie.
Probably not.
Only nine. But ever is a day when there are 13, Susan Zirinsky will be able to name all 13 and give you the bios of them from memory.
Although it was very funny when that scene got shot, I remember thinking, I'm going to have the lists of the cabinet members just in case somebody asks me. These days, I don't even know if all of the cabinets have been filled.
Indeed they have in the Trump administration.
I know. It's an interesting time. And I really am honored to be on this podcast, but I also feel very good about the people who are doing their jobs, who are accountable to no one but CBS and their own moral compass. It's really
an important
time.
And the audience we serve. That's the voice of Susan Zirinsky. This has been a special Legends edition of the Takeout podcast because in every way, shape, and form, for all of her natural life and anything that occurs after that, Susan Zirinsky is a pure and absolute legend at CBS. And I would add,
and in broadcast journalism.
And for broadcast journalism and for all of humanity. I think that pretty much covers it, don't you, Susan?
I will, when I'm dead, just for the record, I will haunt you.
Can't wait.
Cannot wait. Susan Zirinsky, thanks so much. We've been in the cafeteria. What is it called, Steve?
The Primetime Cafe, formerly known as Station Break.
Which in the basement.
I love that old name.
Yeah, in the basement of CBS News Broadcast Center here in New York City. I've been joined by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, political director of CBS News, Steve Shigera. Steve, I think we've had a good time.
It's been a great time and an honor.
Susan?
Thank you. It's my honor. Thank you, gentlemen.
We're all honored, and we're now hungry, so we're going to get some food. Bye.
That was good.